Support for the Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Everyone feels it in their bones. There's something really off, something hinky with this economy. While we are all working longer and harder than ever, it seems like we're not able to dig our way out of this debt hole that we're in. Those medical expenses, college loans, other things we got lying around. Something isn't right about the way the deck is stacked. Billionaires are getting richer, and the working class is getting gouged on rent, paper towels, and cornflakes. Now, a new book takes a look at that. It has some answers, The Quiet Coup, Neoliberalism, and the Looting of America. We're joined by the author, Mirza Baradarane, law professor at the University of California, Irvine, specializing in financial regulation. And Mirza, welcome to The Source.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm honored to be here.
So in your book, The Quiet Coup, you show this link, something that many people would not associate together. We have the campfire of 2018 and the theories of Marjorie Taylor Greene that it was caused by Jewish space lasers, and the overall feeling in America that something isn't right, and it gives fertile ground for these conspiracy theories and the failure of neoliberalism. Connect those dots for me.
So it's exactly as you started out articulating at the beginning of the show, which is that we feel something is wrong. So during the campfire, the Paradise, California campfire disaster, where, 84 elderly residents died in their homes and just the whole town was destroyed. I would link that, since we're in Texas, to the Texas freeze situation as well, where
the Smokehouse Creek fire.
Exactly. Yes. Right. And these utilities are monopolies, essentially, that don't have to compete, but get to keep the profits for their services. And there was so much going on here with this PG&E in California and the Texas utilities. And yet when something like that happens and people have this feeling something's fishy here, someone like Marjorie Taylor Greene, and historically there's anyone that could fill that role, will point to, it's the Jewish, bankers, it's this group, that group. They find a scapegoat because our brains kind of need someone to blame for this. And usually it's, person, group, some other person. And that is a really dangerous pathway that, historically you can look at where that has led. And I try in the book to sort of validate, I did realize at some point while writing this book that me and Marjorie Taylor Greene, as much as I hate to admit it, like we share the same feeling that something's not right. And in the 6 years or so that I spent writing this book, she started her rise in political power with that Facebook post, which was insane. I mean, she just put together a string of insinuations to blame this group. Had no validity, in fact. I mean, there's no technology that shoots lasers in from space, and obviously they're it was just negligence from PG&E for not fixing their wires, even though they had been told many, many times. Why didn't they do it? Because of the shareholder profit motive. And so I follow the real sort of arc here of how we got to where we are. And it is more complex. It took me, 400 pages of this book, where her Facebook post is much more salient and shareable, and say, well, it's those guys' fault. Let's fix it by going after them. And so I want to validate everyone who feels this way, something's rigged, but also to and show that those things often lead to these conspiracy theories. And yet the conspiracy sort of in plain sight. It's just a decades long corrosion of our laws, our regulatory system, and it's really corrupted the way that we regulate businesses versus people. And I can go into that more later, but that was sort of the starting story of the book.
So in your book, The Quiet Coup, Neoliberalism and the Looting of America, it's our duty to break down neoliberalism. because of, yeah. I mean, I was absent today. They taught that at my grade school. So tell me about neoliberalism.
Yeah, so neoliberalism is, you know, the proponents of neoliberalism, you know, this is some, you know, in the 40s and 50s, this group of Austrian economists, you know, we're talking about Hayek or Milton Friedman, the origins of neoliberalism, the word, are, you know, Milton Friedman called their theory of free markets, neo as a new, the new liberalism as a revival supposedly of Adam Smith, and this idea that you free the market and you, you know, give individual liberty. Now, the dawning of the theory starts sort of after the communist threat in the 1940s, but neoliberalism really is like a shape-shifting ideology that takes hold in the 1960s in the Nixon administration. And really it's about this idea that if the government does anything here, and here in the 60s in America, we were talking about the civil rights era, the, you know, feminism, and a real, you know, like the Nader environmentalist movement that was starting as well. So some of the same problems that we experience today, and it was just coming to a head in the 1960s. And this group of economists and policymakers basically said, look, if the government does anything, that's anti-capitalist. And the way toward freedom, look, all these people are saying freedom, the end of racism, the end of war, and the way to do that is the free market. So what does that mean? We're going to make the government small and take away regulation. So that was the idea of neoliberalism, and it's a very attractive idea. The problem is it was the opposite of that. Neoliberalism, as it got embedded in the Nixon White House and then really just started growing into the political order of our time, this we live under neoliberalism, not just in America, but abroad. And what it has created isn't less government, less law, more market competition. It's more law, more complex law, more more lobbyists, more lawyers, more difficulty for small businesses and really anyone who wants to compete in this modern market for competing. And why is that? Because it was never about the free market. It was really about keeping certain corporations fixed in the places that they were in these other countries, in these places where they weren't really complying with the rules of the free market at the time in the 1960s. And so I show kind of that corruption started then. And then it's really the ideology has spread into almost every way we think about the economy, into monetary policy and inflation. Really all the ways that we talk about the economy are I'm proposing a little bit wrong, or a lot wrong.
And so the little guy, he just gets the squeeze.
Yes, right.
And so that's why exactly. We have this. So when we talk about things, I got to hit this break, so I don't want to give you a big fat question right now. But, you know, this kind of explains, you know, we hear it all the time. Let's, you know, let's a free market go and create jobs and everything will be great. But in fact, that doesn't benefit most people. In fact, this exasperates inequality in our society and racism in our society. So we're going to get to all that. It's all part of this when we talk about the book, The Quiet Coup, Neoliberalism and the Looting of America, how this impacts you, and it directly impacts you. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. It's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'll be right back.
Support for TPR comes from La Fonda on Main, honoring the authentic cuisine of interior Mexico since 1932. Open for lunch, brunch, and dinner. More information at lafondaonmain.com.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The book we're talking about, The Quiet Coup, Neoliberalism and the Looting of America. We're joined by the author, Mirza Baradaran, and telling us why we can tell in our bones that there is something wrong with this economy. It's rigged in favor of the wealthy and powerful at the expense of everyday folks. If you got a question, give us a call. How have you noticed this? How do you see it? The number, and how do you not see it? Because part of this whole thing is to kind of do it in the shadows. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Marissa, one of the things I noticed most is how rent continues to go up. There's plenty of actual housing. It's not a housing shortage. It's just that rent continues to go up. And we see that private equity keeps buying up all the apartment complexes, multi-family housing. And then they have to pay back, pay their investors these really huge, returns. And so they jack up their rent. They put in these incredible fees. People are paying fees for things that they don't even need or they want or had never signed up for when they rent apartments. And then if they don't keep up, they get tossed out. They get evicted. And we see that in the streets. You're saying, why do we have this homeless crisis in America? And do you see a connection between the unhoused that we have and the quiet coup?
Yes, exactly. I started my career after law school. I graduated in 2005, went to Wall Street, to do a banking law job, and saw before the crisis when the banks were like, this is a free market, and then during the financial crisis, which was a housing crisis. And we helped, my firm represented all the banks, and we helped put together this Federal Reserve program in which trillions of dollars were sent to these banks that some of your listeners may remember. And really just 100 cents on the dollar, they were restored to profitability within a year. And meanwhile, many people lost their jobs. And at that point, lost their jobs, lost their homes, which is a slump that, while the metrics of the market says that we recovered, a lot of people don't feel that way, because once you lose your home, you don't really get it back. And a lot of people, many people lost their homes. And then at that point, once you have all those, that supply of homes, all of the banks and the equity that had, all their money back, essentially, because of these Fed programs, went around the country buying up homes. Private equity is like the largest owner of single family homes in the country. And here you're looking at, in the book, I break down the origins of neoliberalism and then the process through which it infiltrates the legal system. And then the third sort of part of the book is really about what it's created in a sort of abstract sense. And this is where, going back to Marjorie Taylor Greene, it's really easy to say, oh, those guys did it, and then just blame them. That was in the 60s or 70s. What's happening now is you've got this system of capital, and let's call it usury, for lack of a better word, but there are better words. It's just unregulated interest rates. That also was part of neoliberalism. And capital is this abstraction that is, it just needs to grow. And it needs to grow at least 6% a year. And it has no, there's no caps. Our society, for the first time in hundreds of thousands of years, allowed for interest rates to go as high as, they said anyone is willing to pay for it. But that was a neoliberal idea, is, well, it should be, it's a bargain between two different people. And so there should be no caps. That's over, that's state regulation, it's anti-capitalism. Meanwhile, interest rates are now governing everything. Your student, our education, our retirement, our everything is part of this system of capital that is just growing on the one end. So if you look up at the capital, where is it? It's in these private equity accounts. It's in our 401ks. It's just this massive pool of capital that just needs yield. And so whether it's in housing or the crypto markets or wherever it's going to get yield, it just needs it, and it needs it fast, and it grows. Capital grows at a faster rate than anything that is tied to the physical world, because it has no friction to the physical world. It just can grow and multiply zeros and ones on these balance sheets up there. Meanwhile, on the ground, right, capital is very real. If you don't have it, you lose your home and you're stuck in the debt cycle. So where is capital getting the yield to grow from average people? And is it bringing it back? Well, that's where neoliberalism, this idea of like, if you have enough lawyers, you really don't have to pay taxes. You register offshore. So if you're a private equity firm, you pay 2% on your gains, and the rest of us pay 50% on our gains, right? So it's these kinds of laws that, if you look at the system, it's just very clear that you've got this unsustainable system of capital. growing on one end. I've called it, I use a lot of different metaphors in the book. Is it a zombie, a vampire? Is it a, virus? And ultimately, like I call it a cancer, right? It's a metastatic growth. And it's really hard to see because there are no easy villains. It's just an idea, a meme, AI, let's call it, an algorithm that got implanted in the code of capital, and it just grows in one direction. You can't not grow. And it's not capitalism. It's not about the free market. It really just is about the regulations and the inequality that applies to, if you have this much capital, you get to be exempt from law, basically. And if you have this much capital, you're under it. You're either over it or under it. And a lot of us are under it.
So after that mortgage meltdown bank crisis, there was the passage of Dodd-Frank, which put in some new regulations, some new guardrails to prevent another situation like that. And we saw that when Donald Trump was elected, that many of those things were taken apart. It doesn't really get talked about much, but it seems like one of the reasons that Donald Trump was able to get elected in 2016 was because he ran on doing just that, and he got support from the banking system that he would undo Dodd-Frank. Attempts to fix these things get unfixed pretty quick.
Very quick. In fact, even during the Obama administration, Dodd-Frank was eroded. Dodd-Frank, we had the world, like the closest thing to the Great Depression in the financial system. It was clearly just overly leveraged banks violating all norms and rules, the entire sort of framework, all the things that neoliberalism told us about the free market, about finance, went away in a moment. All of the myths were debunked. And instead of a full scale, what FDR did is, okay, that system failed. We created the banking system because it's always been the public money supporting these banks. And I've written, my previous books are all about this. And I saw it firsthand on Wall Street. It's like, where is this trillions of dollars coming from? Oh, they just pushed this button at the Fed. And then after that button was pushed and after all the money flew in, you would think that there'd be some regulation. Look, if we're at the end of the day, we taxpayers, we government, whatever, are going to subsidize you, bail you out, and we will. That hasn't changed. I mean, look at, the Silicon Valley Bank and all of the recent failures. I mean, they're not full-scale bailouts, but only because they stopped them early before they spread with trillions of dollars. If you're paying attention to the Fed, there's been many bailouts of the scale and scope of the financial crisis bailout. We saw two during COVID, essentially. And that's over there. And then on the one hand, Trump promised, to drain the swamp. And he really does tap in, like Marjorie Taylor Greene, his supporters understand that the system is rigged. I mean, he said on the campaign trail, the system is rigged, the economy is rigged, and I'm going to drain the swamp and all of these promises. At the same time, he is someone who has had a career built on evading rules. I mean, he's very clear that I'm too rich to have to do these rules, and that's like one of the selling points.
Right. Who better to fix it than the guy who's been cheating the system all along? That's to catch a thief sort of thought. Let's go to a caller. We have Jose on the line, and Jose, you're on the air.
Hi, my compliments to your guest. I bought the book as soon as you announced that she was coming on. I looked at the book, I bought it. Well, it looks like it's going to be a good read. A comment on neoliberalism and then a question. My comment is that neoliberalism is hijacked the promise of what would have been the Obama administration. And I'm talking about the promises and the commitments he was making at 2007 when he was running for election. As soon as he came into office, neoliberalism kicked in, and the best interests of the American people were kicked out to the side. The second thing, I have a question for you. Do you see emerging between the two philosophies of neoliberalism and neoconservatism, being that neoliberalism has also adopted and the the cycle of endless wars throughout the world.
Yes.
All right. Jose, thank you for that question and get your reaction.
Yeah, Jose, thank you for bringing those things up. That is a very astute analysis because, yes, Obama, sort of, you know, in chapter 9 of the book, I talk about this exact thing. I was a volunteer for the Obama administration, and a lot of us voted for Obama because he promised two things. He would, you know, drain the swamp. He talked about Wall Street and its excesses. That was the pitch, and hope and change, and, you know, end drones and needless, endless war, and didn't do those things. And I really, you know, got into his memoirs, and I was a watcher, a very careful watcher at the time, but I really went back to this book and to try to, like, really do the autopsy. What happened and at what point? And I don't know if you'll agree with my analysis, but I think it was already too late. And also that he I don't know if he didn't try hard enough or what, but no, I mean, he brought in Larry Summers, which is as big of a spokesman for neoliberalism as you could find.
And Timothy Geithner.
Timothy Geithner, who had been started the bailout as a, you know, New York Fed chair who, you know, the New York Fed is basically, you know, a regulator embedded in these investment banks. And so just by those choices alone, it was over. However, the bailout started and was already on the way before he even got inaugurated. I mean, we had a president just being briefed by the Fed at that point, once he got into office. And so it's not entirely his fault. He would have had to know a lot more, but he could have brought in better people, I think. The same thing with the wars. I mean, he promised to close Guantanamo and end the drone strikes and all of these things, all of the reasons we voted for him. And, you know, he says in his memoir, on the one hand, I promised my voters. On the other hand, you know, Bob Gates said that we needed more troops in Iraq. And so I don't know, you know, President Obama's psychology, and I was a very supporter and I wanted to stay loyal. But I do think neoliberalism is bigger than the president at this point. And that's the tragedy of it, is that it did, you know, I say in that analysis of that is that he snatched the victory of neoliberalism from the jaws of its defeat. Like, it was going down, and he almost resuscitated it with these Fed bailouts, the new justifications for war from a president like Barack Obama. And going back to the origins of neoliberalism, the reason why it's tied into endless war is because, as I show in the early parts of the book, why did this ideology come into the fore? Americans weren't hungry for the free market. In the 1950s and 1960s, we had the world's greatest economy built on a public-private enterprise. You know, it was a war enterprise. And Eisenhower's leaving office, and he says, he warns, like, don't let the military-industrial complex make your political decisions. You know, he says, you can have guns or butter. And yet, you know, Vietnam happened, and what the Nixon administration, and you know, it starts a little bit before that, but it's really Nixon, is that they decide, instead of heeding the call that is now spreading across the world in the 1960s, it's not just the civil rights era here. If you look abroad, you've got all of Latin and South America, you've got the Middle East, Southeast Asia, all of Africa, all of these former colonies, the age of empires over, every single country between 1960 and 1970 has some war or liberation struggle. And that is what neoliberalism stops and replaces it with endless war and continued empire.
So we're going to take another break. I got some callers. We'll get them on the air. But also, I do want to talk about one of the main points you have is that neoliberalism is a destabilizing force in America, particularly with this misdirected anger that a lot of people have. So we can talk about that some more when we come back from the break. Our phone number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The book is The Quiet Coup, Neoliberalism and the Looting of America. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back.
The EarthX 2024 Environmental and Sustainability Congress of Conferences is happening in Dallas, April 22nd through the 26th, bringing together all sides with one important mission: protect our planet. For info, earthx.org.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the ghost in the machine. The machine is the economy, and the ghost inside it is the idea of neoliberalism, that we should have fewer regulations, less restrictions, less interference on the flow of money. And what is that actually doing to the little guy, you and me, and the policies that drive America? It's turning out not to be so great because money has a physics all of its own. It's kind of like gravity. It just gets bigger and bigger, attracts more and more until it has everything. And if you don't got it, then you got nothing. We're talking to the author of the book, The Quiet Coup, Neoliberalism and the Looting of America, Mirza Baradadan. And let's go to a caller. We have Teresa on the air. And Teresa, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking the call. I am going to give you my own opinion about the young people that are university students that did what they did. They had all the right to do it. Because, first of all, they've been told that they're not going to be...
I think we're on a wrong topic. You got us on the wrong day. We're not talking about the university students, but and what's going on out there. So what about the idea that the neoliberalism is an idea that has taken root in America? It would be really difficult to weed it out. That is something that many people think of it as a truism, that the economy, that the government has no, should have no role in the economy.
Yeah. So that let me address two things. You said the thing about money and having its own gravity, and I want to really follow that up because that's a really good way to put it. One of the doomsday scenarios that AI experts talk about is like, well, if you trained an AI to just create paperclips, right? What is the harm that could happen? But if it just kept learning from learning from its mistakes and made more efficient, better paperclips and did it in such a like industrial wide scale. And eventually, it's consuming human beings to just make paperclips, And that's sort of where we're at with money and capital, is that it is programmed in the way that an AI is just to grow. And the premise of that was that if it grows, that it would trickle down, that it would benefit all of us. But that it's just making paperclips at this point. And I think looping in, even what the caller talked about, the protest is, and going back to Obama and Trump and Marjorie Taylor Greene, is that people are sick of the system and they want to push a button. They want to get rid of it. We want out. And when we voted for Obama, many people voted for Trump. I was not a Trump voter, but I understand what led people to, because he was saying change. He wasn't saying hope and change. He was saying change and some punitiveness. And I like that. But that's where we're going, is someone comes in toward the end and says, I will change it. And this is where I strike a darker tone in the book, is in historically, when you have this corruption, this rot in the system, neoliberalism, it started out as an ideology, but became a corruption, in that once you say, oh, under the guise of this ideology of free markets, we're just going to take the government out. But it really wasn't taking the government out. If you have enough lawyers, you just rig the market to serve your interests. There's no such thing as an economy without a society. There's no such thing as, profits and capital without the law. What is money? What is capital besides a legal instrument that is backed by the courts and the laws of the society that we're all part of? And those things are less stable and solid as we think. And when there's widespread corruption and that leads to distrust of institutions, and then most dangerously, distrust of the law. And law and order, the idea that laws are followed is not, a thing that you have one moment and then you don't in another moment. And you can look across the world and see when that happens. And often it's the corruption gets to a certain extent. And then some group from the right, usually some fascists, say, let me fix it. Here's our final solution, as was the case with the Nazis. From the country that I come from, the Middle East, similar, the Islamic, essentially Nazi fascists came in and said, we'll fix it with our own law. And it's going to be dark and rigid and, horrific. But it's, they'll enforce the law now. And Afghanistan, so I don't think we are, at the door of that. But I'm alarmed by some of the proposed solutions that I'm hearing from our policymakers, who, then that's why I focus on Marjorie Taylor Greene, because they say, look, this is a problem, and it's the immigrants' fault. It's the Jewish, you know, bankers' fault. It's these groups that are constantly the other and vilified. And that's how these things tend to go, because abstractions like capital and money and ideology are difficult things to villainize. People are much easier.
Let's go to caller Edward. Edward, you're on the air.
Hey, wonderful show today. I wanted to thank the guest for so elegantly but simply explaining the complex nature of what neoliberalism truly is, and also for pushing back any time anyone has had even an inkling comment of partisanship. It is a truly systemic problem, both parties. It's above any individual or even president, as the guest said. It's so strange that neoliberalism has been both promoted and criticized as market capitalism when it's anything but. It's regulatory capture. It's the original definition of fascism from Mussolini, the merging of the bureaucratic court and corporate states. Meanwhile, in Scandinavia, which we strangely, some of us call socialist, they have freer, less regulated, less taxed markets that actually allow for genuine competition. And I think we all see the results of that. That's my comment.
Edward, thank you so much for that comment. And so, Mercer. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you. And it is the political system that is corrupt seeks to divide us, because it benefits when we see each other as the problem. And it's so easy. Race, gender, partisanship, now identity, have been the oldest tricks in the book. I mean, you look back to Reconstruction in America. You look at the Nazis. You know, this is, the Nazis were a result, were a response to decades of basically extortion by the French and the British and the Americans who signed on, that the Germans after World War I had to pay back all of these debts that was going to crush their society. John Maynard Keynes, his first book, is a great economist of the, you know, 20th century, says if you force Germany to pay back this debt in gold bars, by the way, to the French and the British, who were, you know, the empire then, vengeance will not limp. Bad things will happen. He said this in 1919, which is the year that Hitler comes to the fore. And for 12, 13 years, Hitler's saying the same thing. This is my final solution. This is my final solution. And as Germany is sinking into economic despair and the Great Depression and all of this stuff, and Keynes had laid it out right away. He said, this is the problem. Your problem is the Treaty of Versailles and this deal. And yet they voted him, or however he got into power, to make that thing happen. And so this is the same thing with Reconstruction. During Reconstruction, there was this effort by white sharecroppers and black sharecroppers to go against the cotton oligarchs, who were basically beholden to the British to give them low-priced cotton for indefinitely. And, you know, that's empire. That's how empire kept extracting from us. And then instead of that movement succeeding in the populist and progressive waves in the 1800s, they broke that coalition by giving, you know, the white Southerners white supremacy. And that's when the Klan started. That's when Jim Crow started. It wasn't right after enslavement. It was after a decade of this resistance. And so that was an interregnum in America, that Reconstruction era that got overturned through violence and white supremacy. And I go into this moment of the 60s and look across the world, and we were at another interregnum where the other option, and it's tragic to think of it, but you look at the ways that the civil rights movement here connected abroad. You know, Martin Luther King went to India. You know, Malcolm X went to Mecca. And you had the other way also. All of these liberation struggles were connected in that we just want to be free. We want to be free from empire. We all want to, you know, live our lives free of war and exploitation and extraction. And yet the corporations that were the tentacles of empire at the time did not want to leave those countries, because it was much more profitable to take without paying rather than to pay a market share. And so these countries, you know, in the Bandung treaties, there's a lot of these non-alignment treaties at the time, many, many nations coming to essentially the old empires and saying, look, we don't want communism. We don't. This is not our fight, the Soviet Union and America. We just want sovereignty. We want to do our own things with our own resources. And that's when this corruption of the free market, the idea of freedom, is basically corroded from inside. That's what neoliberalism does. They say, yes, freedom, market freedom. That's the only freedom that is possible. And same thing with other justice. Okay, well, justice efficiency is a way that we're going to measure justice. That was in the legal field that I track. So it's not that they're saying no freedom, right? No, we're going to keep empire. You can't use those ideologies. Once the Nazis take the ideology of racial supremacy into Europe, that idea that the British and the French had used to basically colonize the world is dead. So now you got to regroup. And the way they did it is to call all of these things anti-capitalist. Oh, you want sovereignty and freedom? That's socialism. That's communism. And that's tyranny. And that was the lie. And market freedom isn't the same thing as freedom. And we're seeing that now. We're seeing that it wasn't even market freedom.
Right. So we need some sort of response, something that will translate to everyday voters. You can tell them, here's what's wrong. Here's how we fix it. And no, I'm not a socialist. That's right. I don't see that happening right now. But let's take this break. Our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK, The Quiet Coup, Neoliberalism, and the Looting of America. The conversation continues. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the book, The Quiet Coup, Neoliberalism and the Looting of America. We're joined by Marissa Baradadan. She is the law professor specializing in financial regulation, University of California, Irvine, also author of the book, How the Other Half Banks and the Color of Money. I want to talk about this comes to mind as a historic example of sort of what we're talking about here. And it's the Wyoming Stock Growers Association. This is the Johnson County War in Wyoming. And this is when the cattle barons got together, the big cattle barons of the area, and they accused all the other settlers of being rustlers. The other settlers were banned by law from actually owning cattle at the time because of the power and the might of the cattle barons. And then they hired, they branded them rustlers. They hired gunmen from Texas to go down up there and hunt them down. They started a war. They got the U.S. government involved. They were there to protect their monopoly of being the cattle growers at the time. And their economy of what they wanted was more important than the civil rights, the economic opportunity, and a way of life for anyone else. And to me, this seems like a perfect example explaining like how neoliberalism for them it outweighs for anyone else.
Yes. You have these, I mean, look at John Rockefeller with the Ludlow Massacre. You know, these miners wanted to just get paid more because it's dangerous work to do this mining in Wyoming. And they had a strike, and he called in the National Guard, and people got killed. And after that, he lobbied to get the GDP to include showing like, oh, we're benefiting the economy. Because what the miners were saying is that this is extraction. And that's the origin of the GDP, the numerical measurement of these things. So it is like almost like the doublespeak, the Orwellian doublespeak. We say we want freedom and a free market, the end of sort of these BS barriers to trade. That's what Adam Smith was talking about. He wrote The Wealth of Nations in 1776, the same year that the Declaration of Independence was written by Thomas Jefferson. They were arguing against the same thing. You can't force your laws through empire on us. And there was all of these restrictions into like trade and all of this stuff. And so these neoliberals come in and say, oh yeah, we are neoliberal. Neo Adam Smith. They held up Adam Smith as this is the guy that we're following because it's going to lead to freedom. But it was the exact opposite. And it was just a corrosion. It was like a double speak. You infiltrate the word freedom and make it essentially meaningless. And the danger here is this, that you infuse your laws and your rhetoric with hypocrisy, and that's you put in the seed of corruption and it grows, and then it becomes diffuse enough where now we just have this inchoate distrust of all institutions, and it's partisan and it's racist and it's all of this stuff. But it's really because freedom doesn't mean, we don't have market freedom and we don't have democracy. And so we're out here arguing socialism versus capitalism. Stalin wasn't socialism. That was tyranny. He was killing people in the gulag. And just like America has never been capitalism, we've had either state-supported, and I support this, right? State-supported mortgage loans, during FDR's reign. That's how most Americans got a home. That's not capitalism. That was the great state program. It left out, the black population. But that wasn't because of capitalism. And so when the black population say, we want that too, that's when capitalism comes in as a weapon. Okay, so when these words stop meaning what they're meaning, we're out here arguing over meaningless distinctions and fighting to the death, Hayek versus Keynes, as though either of these things are really ruling our economy, where it's really just, lobbyists getting these loopholes to go off. Most of American corporations aren't even registered in America. They're in the Cayman Islands or in, Ireland. Apple's basically an Irish company. Bezos is off. These billionaires aren't paying taxes to America, and we just create those laws. And that's like a one-way ratchet. The more money you have, the more laws you can buy. The more laws you can buy, the more money you can make. The more money you can make, the more laws you can buy. That's been going for the last decades, and they called it free market capitalism. And that's a huge problem, because now we're saying, well, so the left says now we're against free market capitalism. And the right says, no, we need more free market capitalism, we need less government, because they think that that's what's happening here. But the government, since neoliberalism, since they promised less government, it's ballooned. It's grown exponentially, the government. Government spending has grown. Spending on war, spending on weapons, spending on just laws. Dodd-Frank was 2,000 pages, and there was even more to be made, more laws that are still being made. Whereas, FDR, when he regulated the bank, it was like a 34-page bill. Just, you can do Wall Street stuff, you do banking stuff. And so the laws are, it's basically a pay-to-play. Who can understand 2,000 pages of law? Well, very specialized lawyers on Wall Street that you have to pay a lot of money. I was one of those lawyers. I am a specialist in this. And, who can afford someone that has spent decades learning just Dodd-Frank? Well, just, basically Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan.
Let me go to a caller.
Not a community bank.
Let me go to a caller. Yeah. We have Bob waiting on the phones. Yeah. And Bob, thanks for hanging on. You're on the air.
Hey, no problem. Thank you for the topic. And it's great and timely. And I really, right before the break, David, you had talked about how do we fix it? Because what I hear is a lot of history and a lot of momentum. It's basically this momentum that just keeps getting bigger and bigger and going. And you ask, well, how do we fix it? And that's what I want to know, without being accused of being socialist.
All right, Bob, thank you so much. Absolutely. Appreciate your call.
Thank you for getting back on track, because I tend to go on tangents. I'm not confident that the federal government can do this anymore. I still think we vote our principles and our conscience, and we vote for the least damage. But I think at this point, money has more rights than people. And because we've been fed a lie about what is profits and what is money, I think it's faster to get to justice through investing in it rather than hoping that the laws change up above. And so I'm currently working on this. I'm an academic, so I'm not asking people for money to invest in things, but I am saying it is more profitable to invest in peace and justice, to eradicate our segregated economy, to eradicate war, to not invest in weapons. That's more profitable, to not invest in, you know, certain the things that are draining our economy. Because as I show in the book, and if you read, you know, to the end, you'll see that it wasn't even just that these corporations took over the government. It was basically three industries that got in there in the 1960s. It was weapons, oil, and tobacco, oddly. And those industries were dying. They were the losers of the post-empire world. We were moving on to, you know, different resources of, you know, to that weren't as extractive. And those industries have been fighting this pitched battle to stay, you know, subsidized essentially by the federal government. And that is costing all of us. And so I think, you know, I'm trying to make the case in this book, and will continue to, that it's more profitable for us to look at the world and invest in our futures. You know, my 401k, when I took out the stock, it was in a diversified fund. And I say this in the conclusion, I was shocked to find that I myself, having pushed a button at my work just to put my money in a 401k, was invested in things like Exxon and Raytheon and JP Morgan Chase, the stuff that I was writing about. This is not, if I retire at 65 and get my 401k and those are still profitable industries, I don't want to live in that world. And it's very difficult to move your money, take your money out of the 401k. So we're sort of bound by our own investments. You know, Justice Brandeis talks about this. The people are bound by the fetters of their own gold. And this is the trap of the market. And so I'm working on, and will continue to urge others to look at these ways. You know, the law at this point is just this nice little playground of loopholes. So that's a place where those who want to make change can also play in that realm. We've sort of left the corporations to this extractive state. And I'm actually even talking to the corporate people
Let me ask you quickly. We're almost out of time here. The Occupy movement seemed like the best way, in the most overt public way, to try and challenge and bring attention to this. But of course, it was very frustrating for me to try to deal with them. What are the lessons in about a minute and a half here or two that we can learn from the Occupy movement?
I mean, the Occupy movement was a great response to that time. But we have been, as those who want reform, looking to the federal government. And I think it's time to look at the market, to, you know, go to the money people and say, you want to make money? Let me show you why this system is itself cannibalizing. It's this AI zombie cancerous thing, and we can invest in our own futures, and our futures don't have to be endless war and corruption and these loopholes. So I think the Occupy movement was just a response, just like the student protest movement, just like anyone who's ever protested against the, you know, Iraq wars. I was one of them, to say, we don't want to do that. We don't like this. And so it's hard to say, oh, well, this is our agenda going forward. But what you're seeing across the board, and if we're generous, you can include from the right all the way to the left. I'm putting Occupy in the same as the other movements, the ones that aren't co-opted. You know, the Tea Party sometimes got co-opted by the big money donors. But the ones that are truly grassroots, that bubble up from the bottom, those people, I want to talk to all those. We are all one. We all have one goal, and that's to remove this corrupt BS from our laws and to really actually just have a free market, because I think that's the answer, a free market. But we need freedom first.
Mirza Baradaran is the author of the book, The Quiet Coup, Neoliberalism and the Looting of America. Mirza, thank you so much for coming on the air and talking to us today. Appreciate that.
Thank you so much for having me. This was wonderful.
And that's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.